Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Attorney General William Barr has been under fire for a week now, ever since he sought to lower the sentencing recommendation for President Trump's longtime friend Roger Stone. And today he's being urged to resign. More than 1,100 former federal prosecutors and Justice Department officials signed a letter yesterday urging Barr to step down. Matt Zapatosky joins us now. He covers the Justice Department for The Washington Post. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Matt, how much pressure is Barr under right now? And I guess the bigger question is, are there any indications that he even consider resigning?
I don't think he's going to resign, particularly not because of this letter from outside Justice Department people, former Justice Department people. But he is under significant pressure internally. Morale at the Justice Department, I think, hit a real low mark during his tenure this week because of everything that happened regarding the Roger Stone sentencing recommendation, his ABC interview where he sort of took aim at President Trump's tweets, and now this letter from former Justice Department officials. He is facing pressure internally to maintain the Justice Department's historic independence. And while I don't think he's going to quit, he's under some pressure.
You know, last week we all watched as Barr gave this extraordinary interview on ABC News in which he said that the president's tweets about cases before the Justice Department made it, quote, impossible for me to do my job. Right after that, the president continued to tweet. What is exactly the mood in the Justice Department right now? You kind of mentioned the morale is low.
Yeah, I think it depends on who you talk to. I think some employees were very heartened by Barr's ABC interview. You know, that was a pretty remarkable moment. You haven't seen in the Trump administration sitting cabinet secretaries call out the president like that. But some were kind of suspicious. Barr has been very, very, very loyal to the president throughout his tenure. And some people inside the Justice Department wondered, well, is this just sort of all for show? Is he saying this publicly, but he's still going to sort of behave in the same way he has? So we'll see. Morale is low, but the mood is mixed. And I think the ABC interview did help him a little bit.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the decisions that Barr has made. Since Friday, he asked outside prosecutors to examine the case against former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who Trump calls a good man. And he also decided not to pursue criminal charges against former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, who Trump has rallied against. And you actually reported the McCabe decision really infuriated the president. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so this is a case that has long been just sort of sitting there. McCabe has been such a nemesis to President Trump. McCabe is the guy who opened up the investigation into whether President Trump obstructed justice. That investigation was ultimately taken over by the special counsel. And President Trump just constantly attacked him on Twitter and public, all sorts of places. So a prosecution of him might have been viewed as sort of the president going after a political nemesis. But Barr wouldn't do it. The Justice Department decided that it wasn't going to charge McCabe, and that really put a strain on Barr and Trump's relationship, which was already sort of reeling from the ABC interview.
So you say bringing in outside prosecutors in the Flynn case is part of a larger trend, which is really to re-examine the work of Special Counsel Robert Mueller and his Russian investigation. What other examples can you point to in that? What's so unusual about it?
Yeah, so if you take this back even before Attorney General Barr was in place and Attorney General Sessions was there, Sessions appointed an outside prosecutor, a guy named John Huber, to look into all these Clinton-related concerns. Now, we reported earlier this year that nothing really came of that case. More recently, Attorney General Barr has appointed a different U.S. attorney, John Durham, to sort of reinvestigate the investigators on the Russia investigation. Mm-hmm. He's looking at how the whole thing got started. Those are two examples. You've also seen Attorney General Barr create kind of a unique pipeline for Rudy Giuliani to get Ukraine-related information, and that's going through the U.S. attorney in Pittsburgh.
Let's talk a little bit about Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani, who is President Trump's personal lawyer, is now under investigation by federal prosecutors in New York. And at the same time, another part of the Justice Department is collecting additional information about him, about his investigation of Joe Biden and Ukraine. This all feels pretty extraordinary.
it's very unusual. I mean, it's unusual for the Justice Department to create kind of a special pipeline to handle incoming information, because they take incoming information all the time and they're just normal channels. But in this instance, they've kind of given Rudy Giuliani a unique mechanism to report information. So that's interesting in its own right. So you have a guy who the Justice Department is investigating, who's trying to get the Justice Department to investigate other folks. It's just a very wild situation.
That's Matt Zapotosky. He is a national security reporter covering the Justice Department for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We're coming up on a time of year when many college students apply for internships. But even if they get an offer, the bigger question is whether they can afford to take it. Many internships are still not paid in the United States, and students struggle balancing them while also going to class and paying off student loans and working part-time. Joining us now is someone working to change this. Carlos Mark Vera is the co-founder of the nonprofit Pay Our Interns. He was previously an intern for Congress in the White House. Carlos, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm a follower of the hashtag PayOurInterns on Twitter, and actually this summer I went down a rabbit hole reading the stories of people working two and three jobs just so they could have this internship experience. And when you started this movement in 2016, you had just finished up several unpaid internships. What were those experiences like for you as a college student?
So my first unpaid internship was on the Hill. And, you know, because I grew up in a low-income family, I had to do a part-time job and then take six classes as a 17-year-old while I was interning over 30 hours a week. I remember those days of just fighting not to fall asleep while I was doing my internship, or, you know, walking down the hallways of Congress and realizing that, you know, no one looks like you except the custodian. And then, you know, at the White House where, you know, you have to wear a suit every day. So those are just some things that people don't think about when, you know, the internship requirement says professional clothing. That costs a lot of money. Especially when you're not getting paid anything.
I think the old thought process was, hey, you have to pay your dues through an internship. But as your movement points out, it's kind of an elitist way of thinking because it assumes an intern has the supports to take on unpaid labor. Has that changed at all these days in the United States?
So first I want to say we have a tagline, and it's experience doesn't pay the bills.
Yeah,
because it does not. And you're right. You know, when we founded this, people thought of it kind of like world peace. It sounds nice, but it's not going to go anywhere, especially in this political climate. Yet, you know, we made them possible, right? And back in, you know, 2 years ago, we got Congress to come together and agree on creating a $14 million intern fund, which now has been increased. And, you know, just in the past 2 years, it's $31 million, so that each office has allotted money to start offering paid internships. And when they passed that, it really sent a strong signal around D.C. and across the country that, you know, times were changing. And we've started to see so many more organizations and nonprofits do the same. So, for example, like the PR Council in New York, they represent over 100 PR firms. They passed a rule that, you know, all their PR firms that they represent must pay interns starting this year. We've worked with presidential campaigns, with other organizations. And also, this has allowed to have that conversation because, you know, there are folks in countless organizations that want to change the policies internally, right? But sometimes they just don't have the power. So this has really given them that space to speak up and say, you know what, maybe we should do something different.
As you said, you've been working quite a few years on this. You work with interns as well as schools and employers to improve these paid internship opportunities. I'm just kind of thinking about how it's not just the onus of a company, and especially when we're talking about smaller companies, many of them might say, well, hey, we can't really afford to pay our interns. What do you think these groups need to do to work better when it comes to offering paid internships? I'm just thinking about the relationship between schools and companies.
You know, for those small companies, I can sympathize, right? Like, we're a small nonprofit and we pay our interns. I think the first thing is being intentional about, like, adding that to your budget. If it is limited, you know, say, hey, you know what, at a minimum, we can give you a stipend for transportation and to cover your food cost. Other potential ways is working with the university. More schools nowadays are offering stipends for their students to intern. And now even some state governments are passing tax credits so that you, if you, you know, take on a student and you pay them, you can get a tax credit. So a lot of it is just being creative and asking for help.
You know, there isn't a lot of data out there on the number of paid versus unpaid internships, but you've been collecting a lot of anecdotes. What have you been learning about how folks are dealing with this?
That is one of the parts that is the most frustrating for us, is just the lack of data. So like Department of Labor doesn't even actually track. Like, we don't know how many interns there are across the country, really. The question then becomes, you have to look at sectors where, you know, the political world and the nonprofit world still is, you know, overwhelmingly unpaid, which I also think there should be a nuance. The movement isn't just about saying, hey, pay, but also pay an adequate amount, because you have employers saying, oh, we offer paid internships, you know, in D.C., New York or Boston. And you ask them, well, how much are you paying? They're like, oh, $400 stipends for 6 months. Mm. And, you know, that barely covers transportation. So what we've ended up doing is teaching a lot of these interns negotiation skills, how to advocate for themselves. And we're realizing that these are skills that they're learning at a young age that will then help them on later on their career.
That's Carlos Mark Vera. He is the founder of the nonprofit Pay Our Interns. Carlos, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Tanya.
Last year, singer-songwriter Larry Sanders, best known for singing the hook on Coolio's famed song Gangster's Paradise, found himself in an unusual situation.
Police come and said that they got a call that we was over there being loud and drinking, which we wasn't. And it was as they came in the park, so they come over there and... you know, got to asking police questions, this and that. You're on parole, who's on probation?
He was hanging out at a park near his home in South Central L.A. when police officers approached he and his friends.
I think maybe they got mad because I told them that I was old enough to be their father. One thing went from, you know, from their mind to the next thing. And so they started searching, patting us down.
The officers, he says, took their names and then left. A week later, Sanders received a letter in the mail. It said he was now part of something called CalGang, a database law enforcement agencies use to keep tabs on gang members.
And I'm like, wow, that's kind of crazy.
It's so ironic. Ironic because you actually worked at this park as a gang interventionist.
Yeah, for 8 years I've been doing it. You know, safe passage for the kids. We provide food for the kids. We provide games for the kids. Whatever the kids want, this is what we try to provide for them through the summer.
Sanders was able to hire a lawyer, and recently he's been taken off that list. But all of this, he says, has taken an emotional toll.
I'm like, wow, they picked up this time now. I got grandkids. I have kids. You know, thank God my grandkids don't look at Spectrum News or read the newspapers or stuff like that. Because I know they'd be like, Papa, what's going on? What are you doing with this? Because in their eyes, you know me, I'm an angel in their eyes. And my kids, they was asking me like, Dad, what's going on? I said, man, it's not real, man. Even when I was going to church, people in church were like, hey, man, what's going on with you with this? We know you're not into that. We're praying for you. You know, I'm like, man, this is crazy.
The state of California is now reviewing the Los Angeles Police Department's use of this statewide gang database after reports surfaced that officers have falsified records and added innocent people to the list. This isn't the first time CalGang has come under fire. The database is an index of more than 80,000 gang members, accessible to 140 local, state, and federal agencies. And advocates have long said this system is flawed and disproportionately impacts Black and brown men. To talk more about this review, we have with us California Attorney General Javier Becerra. Welcome to Here and Now.
Tanya, thanks for having me.
California voters passed a law called AB 90 in 2017, which gives the Attorney General's office oversight over this database. What steps is your office taking now in reviewing that database, and why now?
Tanya, after the state auditor came out with a report showing that there were problems with the CalGang system in California, the legislature authorized the California Department of Justice to issue regulations so that we could have some uniform standards on how we use the CalGang system. And so we're in the process right now of issuing those regs. That'll give every law enforcement agency a clear sense of how to use the system, and hopefully it'll have far more integrity once it is used.
Yeah, I'm just curious about the findings and what comes after the findings. If your office finds that there was actual misuse, what repercussions might the LAPD face?
So here now you're talking about a specific case of the Los Angeles Police Department versus our statewide regulations that we're in the process of issuing. And in this particular case, right, in this particular case, there were reports that the system was not used properly by certain officers. And as I'd like to tell folks, if you have bad inputs of information in a database, you're going to produce nothing but bad outputs in that database. And so you can't rely on the information put in, then you won't be able to rely on the information you use thereafter within the database to move forward on your law enforcement activities. And so we took the steps to communicate with LAPD and indicate to them that we wanted to do some of our own work to find out what happened. We are working with them to get information, but we are acting independently to come to our own conclusions about what happened in the case of the LAPD based on these reports of misuse.
And thanks for that clarification. I just want to be clear that you're reviewing LAPD's use, but you're also taking a look at the overall program and how it's used throughout the state.
That's right. Once the legislature, through this new law, gave us the authority to review CalGang and to scrub it and clean it up, that it also gave us some ability to look at the way certain agencies are using it. And obviously the reports came out last month dealing with the LAPD. And so now we're taking on this the subject of trying to find out what the heck happened at Los Angeles.
You mentioned some of the potential reforms and new regulations. What are the potentials for new reforms and what can we expect in that rollout?
So, Tanya, we've gone through a pretty extensive rulemaking process to be able to issue some regulations. And what we're trying to do is ensure the integrity of the information so that when an officer plugs in certain information into the database about a particular individual who may be a suspected gang member, we're getting information that's backed up by facts. There are documented facts. It's just not an opinion by an officer about the status of this particular individual. We're also making sure that there is meaningful supervision and review of the entry of this type of information into the database. And we're going to call for a frequent auditing of the information that's put into the system.
Because really the whole purpose of something like a database is so that the different agencies are aligned in knowing what department is looking at what particular group or person, really to help streamline and improve law enforcement, correct?
That's it. The database is an intelligence tool. It's an investigative tool. It's not a decision maker. It doesn't mark someone. It doesn't say you're guilty of anything. It's simply a tool that's used internally among law enforcement, the law enforcement community, to try to help them get closer to solving crimes or preventing crimes. If the information that that tool has is defective, then you can imagine that the investigative work, the intelligence work will be defective and the end result might not be what it should be.
That last part you said is an important distinction because there are people who are saying that they were put on LAPD's database list who were not gang members and regular citizens and have been harmed because they were on this database and say they were stopped for a traffic infringement or something. And they're in this database. And so that really impacts their day-to-day lives. What efforts, if any, is there to right the wrongs for people who may have been erroneously put on this list?
Now, that's where we're hoping that by scrubbing the system to make sure that the inputs of information into this database are solid, that we won't have those types of problems. Each agency has control over what it puts into the system. The California Department of Justice will have oversight over the database overall, but we don't control what an individual officer through his or her agency is providing to the database. So we have to do everything we can as the collector of the information to make sure the information is as accurate as possible. But it's each agency's responsibility, each law enforcement agency on the ground's responsibility to make sure that their officers and their personnel are doing this the right way. And so that's why these regulations that we're getting ready to issue are going to be so important, because it'll tell every agency what the process is that they must follow to make sure that their inputs are accurate.
Yeah, there's this larger issue at play here. Civil rights advocates have argued this impacts Black and Latinos more than any other racial and ethnic groups. I know your position as the Attorney General and investigating, but can you talk a little bit about this larger issue and really part of your investigation being an important part to stop that disproportionate view of Black and Latino folks from happening?
Tanya, obviously I'm an attorney general, but I'm also a person of color. I mentioned in my confirmation hearings back in 2017 that I at one point was stopped with some friends when I was a teenager for I don't believe any particular reason. Fortunately, nothing happened. I was not cited or there was no arrest. But looking back at that stop, there was no reason, no valid legal reason for me to be stopped. We know this goes on. And what we want to do is make sure that we address that. I don't want to paint anyone with the same broad brush. There are a lot of men and women, including men and women of color, who serve in our law enforcement agencies who do this work the right way all the time. And what we want to make sure is that we're doing exactly what everyone expects us to do. We are protecting them. We're providing public safety, and we're doing it the way the law and the Constitution require. And so this new effort on the part of the Department of Justice to scrub the system to make sure the Cal Gang database is providing accurate information is absolutely important. At the same time, finding out what happened in the particular case of the Los Angeles Police Department is crucial because it's the biggest user of the database, and their work to clean up what happened will be essentially the marker of how we move forward with the Cal Gang system.
That's California Attorney General Javier Becerra. Thank you so much for your time.
Tanya, thank you.
We've reached out to the LAPD for comment on this review. They have yet to respond. There are now more than 71,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus. More than 1,700 people have died. The vast majority of those cases and deaths are in China, where authorities have adopted emergency measures to control the spread of the virus. Millions of people are being required to stay home inside of their houses, and in many places, they can't leave without permission. That has left thousands of business owners trying to figure out how to stay open as more of their employees work from home. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. And Robin, this work from home proposition is an attempt, as I said, to slow the spread of the virus and to try to keep the economy moving. Can you give us a scope of how big of an impact all of this has been on industries and businesses?
Oh, that's right. China, which is ground zero for this virus, it has upward of 60 million people on some sort of lockdown. And we've seen air traffic grind to a halt. Factories are running at reduced capacity, if they're running at all. And all this in the most powerful planned economy, I think, in the history of the planet.
Right.
And so when you step back from it internationally, the research firm Dun & Bradstreet found that at least 51,000 companies worldwide, and there are 163 of them in the Fortune 1000, have one or more direct main supplier
wow.
in this impact region.
You know, I guess it really depends on the type of work, but how effective is this idea of working from home, this experiment? How is it working out?
So far, it's working for digital and professional services employees, especially in the financial capitals of Shanghai and Hong Kong. Even as the cabin fever takes its toll, the internet has stayed on. The intrepid delivery men, they've been pouncing on the opportunity to moped over food, groceries, toiletries. The teleconferencing technology, it's helping. But that's only so relevant to employees who can do this remotely for so long. At some point, you draw down on inventories and you have to be there. You can only automate and telecommute so much.
Yeah. You mentioned this flourishing delivery, grocery and restaurant delivery industry. Could this perhaps be a sea change where maybe after the virus runs its course, online ordering and delivery will be bigger?
I mean, it is striking. It says 83% of all stores on one of China's largest delivery platforms was closed. So the ones who have managed to stay open, they have pricing power. At the same time, customers are making unusual requests. you know, use hand sanitizer before you walk into the building. You have to get your temperature taken by the doorman. Leave it at the elevator, push the button, and walk away. Mm. And this has all caused quite a bit of food and services inflation. We saw a stat, China's overall consumer price index, which was up between 2 and 3% during most of 2019. It jumped 5.5% last month.
With the little time I have with you, I want to ask you about something else. The schools in China, they're still closed during this outbreak. What happens to students who are shut out of school or unable to attend? Is there a plan for continuing their education?
Yes, there's online learning. There's lectures on TV and on demand. You have about 180 million students potentially studying from home. So the Ministry of Industry and Information, it's coordinating with the top tech and telco players in the country on an e-learning platform. 7,000 servers, 90 terabytes of bandwidth, up to 50 million students could thus use it at the same time. I mean, these are the pluses of living in such a centrally planned economy.
Yeah, I'm actually reading that 180 million students are now staying home because of this virus. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. As always, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya. Good to talk to you.
Last year, more than a dozen nurses' strikes erupted across the country. Their number one demand? Better nurse-to-patient ratios. For years, nurses have argued that they are assigned too many patients and that it's leading to inferior, even dangerous care. That's resulted in a national push for safe staffing legislation that would limit how many patients a nurse can be responsible for. But hospitals have struck back, saying mandated ratios would hamstring facilities that already struggle with limited resources and reduced available care. Liz Tung of WHYY's The Pulse reports.
It was a busy night at the ER, and Melissa Bertoletti was struggling to keep up. As usual, she was the only triage nurse on duty. It was her job to single-handedly keep admissions flowing by assessing and prioritizing each and every patient who came through the door. The ER was already crowded when a woman in her 40s, along with her husband, came in.
The woman was having back pain, kind of side pain. We call it flank.
Bertoletti checked her vitals and had her sit down. Then she turned back to the chaos of assessing patients. But after a while,
the lady came up to the desk with the husband again, and she said, I can't take the pain anymore. The pain is excruciating. So I called in the back to try to get her a room right away because they had already been waiting, you know, 1 or 2 hours.
But as Bertoletti was making the call, a new patient came in, and he did not look good.
He came in clutching his chest. He was gray. He had beads of sweat on his nose. I knew he was in trouble.
As in, she knew he was having a heart attack. So Bertoletti rushed to try and get him a bed. But when she got back, she found the woman who'd been complaining about side pain lying on the floor.
You know, that woman died. She died. She died waiting in the emergency room.
Bertoletti later found out the woman had an aortic dissection, meaning her heart basically exploded.
I felt defeated because I went to nursing school to help people and to save lives. And I feel like I failed that woman. If there was another nurse up front with me, we could have reassessed her. But there was no other nurse to help me.
What Bertoletti went through is something thousands of nurses across the country deal with on a daily basis: short staffing. A survey conducted in 2018 found that only 20% of nurses in the U.S. feel like their staffing levels are safe. And this issue has nurses taking to the streets.
We are in a moment of crisis.
Early last year, more than 10,000 nurses in New York threatened to strike over staffing issues.
We need a contract with safe staffing ratios. Thank you.
A few months later, thousands more in 4 other states launched their own strikes, all of them related to safe staffing. And near the end of the year, nurses in Massachusetts held a candlelight vigil to protest proposed cuts to nurse staffing.
Ratios do indeed improve patient outcomes, save money, save lives.
Doris Carroll is one of the co-founders of the group Nurses Take DC. It's a grassroots group that advocates for mandated nurse-to-patient ratios. It's an idea that nurses' unions have spent years fighting for, mostly without success. The one exception being California. The state passed a ratios law in 1999 that limited each nurse to no more than 4 patients at once, though the exact number can fluctuate based on the unit. But in other states, there is no safety cap. And some nurses complain that they're handling as many as 8 or 10 or even more patients at once, which Carol says is a huge safety issue.
Nurses' number one duty to a patient is to be the patient advocate. And when we say it's unsafe at the bedside, it's unsafe. We're not making this up, and we have research to back us up.
But across the country, nurse-to-patient ratios have faced a lot of resistance. Danny Chun is a spokesman for the Illinois Health and Hospital Association, which is Illinois' leading hospital lobby group. Here's what he had to say about ratios.
It's a deeply flawed, inflexible, rigid approach to setting staffing levels that does not improve quality, safety, or outcomes, but in fact would adversely affect patients.
The group Chun works for has been speaking out against a proposed law in Illinois that would set limits on how many patients a nurse gets assigned. And Chun says the law could have some serious unintended consequences, including less healthcare to go around. Basically, the crux of his argument is we already don't have enough nurses. If we start limiting how many patients nurses can care for, we're going to have to ration care, turn people away. Or, worst case scenario,
hospitals close, including small hospitals in rural areas of the state and safety net hospitals in urban areas.
But one of the biggest arguments that the hospital industry makes against mandated ratios is there's simply no proof that they work.
The evidence is not conclusive that ratios improved quality, safety, or outcomes.
The hospital industry has spent millions of dollars on ads that push these arguments. And it has an unlikely ally, the American Nurses Association.
So, you know, I don't want to say we oppose ratios. I want to say our approach is different.
That's Janet Habler. She's a policy director at the American Nurses Association. And she says they're not against ratios per se. What they do oppose is passing laws about ratios.
We're opposed to legislated ratios. It would require going back to the legislature to change the numbers when an adjustment is needed. We support flexibility and the individual units within a facility, no less each unit, staffing to what works for them.
Mandated ratios, she says, lack flexibility and don't take into account a whole host of important factors, like how experienced a nurse is or the needs of specific patients. Instead, the American Nurses Association supports having committees of nurses decide for themselves what staffing should be. Ideally, Habler says those decisions should take into account a variety of factors, including what's called patient acuity. That's where, instead of a fixed number of patients, nurses' assignments change based on their patients' needs.
In other words, kind of anticipating or forecasting what a patient's care level or degree of care might be on a given shift, which, again, can shift and adjust.
Linda Aiken directs the Center for Health Outcomes and Policy Research at the University of Pennsylvania. And she disagrees with the argument that there isn't evidence that staffing ratios improve patient outcomes.
We have very good evidence that not only in the U.S. but in other countries that have adopted nurse-to-patient ratios, that staffing has improved and patient outcomes have improved as a result.
Specifically, they've been seeing fewer complications, fewer infections, fewer injuries. In fact, Aiken says nurse staffing is the single most important factor that we can control when it comes to patient mortality. She's looked at the evidence in California, which has had a ratio law since the 90s, and more recently, Queensland, Australia. They've had a law since 2015.
No hospitals closed because they couldn't get nurses, and no other part of the healthcare system was impacted either, like nursing homes. No access to care problems, no emergency rooms closing, no consumer paid any more money as a result of this legislation that required hospitals to staff in an evidence-based way.
A lot of those worries come from the idea that there's a nursing shortage in the U.S. But Aiken says, at least on a national level, that's actually not true.
There isn't enough nursing care in a lot of hospitals, but that's not because there's a nursing shortage. It's because the hospitals are not employing enough nurses.
At the bottom of all of this, of course, is money. The hospital industry says employing the extra nurses needed to meet ratios would be impossibly expensive. But Aiken and other researchers have found that ratios could actually help hospitals save money because nurses prevent expensive things like patient infections and injuries.
Money is saved because if people don't come back to the hospital, you can literally save millions of dollars.
Aiken says that ratios aren't a silver bullet. She says acuity, where staffing changes according to patients' needs, is also very important. Both National Nurses United and Nurses Take DC support legislation that incorporates both. They say acuity offers nuance, while ratios provide a clear safety minimum. Doris Carroll of Nurses Take DC says that so far they haven't seen much success in their fight, but they're still pushing to get their message out there, waiting to be heard.
You know, nurses are the most trusted profession. When will they learn to trust our instincts, our research? That's what I want to know.
For Here and Now, I'm Liz Tung.
This month, an iceberg nearly the size of Atlanta broke off in Antarctica. In the words of one scientist, it was both beautiful and terrifying. The glacier, known as Pine Island, is one of the fastest retreating glaciers in Antarctica, where the climate is changing rapidly. Recently, temperatures reached 70 degrees on some parts of the continent. For more on how Antarctica's warmer temperatures and retreating glaciers could affect the world's coastlines, we're joined by Allison Bonwell via Skype. She's a glaciologist at the University of Colorado. Allison, welcome.
Great. Thank you. It's great to speak to you.
Well, Allison, I want to talk to you first about the erosion of this Pine Island glacier. Can you tell us why it's so important?
So, yeah, it's extremely important because Pine Island Glacier and its neighboring Thwaites Glacier is one of the main pathways for ice entering the Amundsen Sea from the West Antarctic ice sheet. And Thwaites and the Pine Island Glacier together have the ability to raise global sea levels by 4 feet in total, which is a huge amount. Also, since 2012, Pine Island Glacier has been shredding 58 billion tons of ice a year, which makes it the biggest single contribution to global sea level rise of any glacier on the planet. So, yeah, it's super important glacier.
And this sea level rise is important because it impacts people in a pretty profound way.
Yeah, I mean, raising sea levels even just by a few centimeters, even a few millimeters, is going to start flooding low-lying communities worldwide. So many towns and cities are, almost at sea level at this point.
And so when we saw the Pine Island Glacier break off, I mean, we're talking about significant pieces here.
Yeah, they're pretty huge. So, in fact, on February 9th, 120 square miles of ice broke off from Pine Island Glacier. That's about three times the size of San Francisco. But then that large piece quickly broke into lots of little pieces, apart from this one bit, which is this iceberg that's now been named B49, that's about 24 square miles in size, which is about two times the size of Washington, D.C. And just to give you an idea of the frequency of these events, so in the past, large icebergs would break from Pine Island Glacier about every 4 to 6 years, but now calving seems to be occurring almost annually, I'd say about every 14 to 15 months.
I want to ask you a little bit more about calving. That's the loss of ice that really is a normal process for all glaciers, but this recent Pine Island Glacier loss is different. How so?
Sure. So I should first say that it's very normal for parts of ice shelves on the seaward front to carve off as icebergs. But if the icebergs break off at a rate that matches the glacier's forward flow, then the ice front stays in place. But if the icebergs are carving at a faster rate than the glacier's flow, then the glacier will retreat, which is what is happening to Pine Island Glacier. And in fact, it's extremely fast at the moment. It's exceeding 35 feet per day. And in the lead up to this recent calving event, it was moving even more rapidly than that. And it was in that period that we started seeing the rifts forming at the ice front. we're particularly worried about the future of this glacier because the front of the glacier was buttressing against a tributary ice flow from the southwest. But in 2018, there was another calving event, and at that point, the Pine Island Glacier lost contact with that tributary glacier, meaning that it now has less support. So it has nothing to buttress up against at this point. So it's much more likely to calve in the future. There's much more likelihood of cracks forming.
We've been talking a lot about climate change and the impact of climate change. Can you talk a little bit about this increased meltdown and what exactly is causing this? Is it really just the change in temperature?
Well, it's two things. It's the change in air temperature, but also the change in the ocean temperature. So 90% of a floating glacier is actually in the ocean. So the more rapidly the ocean is warming, the more rapidly the ice shelf that's in it is going to be melting. And on that note, I should also say that an ice shelf, a floating glacier that is actually in the water, is already floating, is not directly going to contribute to sea level rise. But ice shelves are important because they buttress the inland ice that's on land from flowing into the ocean. And it's that ice on land, once it gets into the ocean, that will contribute to sea level rise.
You know, it's very important for us to know about this and understand this because of the impact it has on us. But what can we really do to mitigate this, if anything?
Every little helps. We can all try and do better by cutting down on our flying, particularly long-distance flying, less driving, using electric cars or hybrid cars at least, turning off light switches. I mean, yeah, every small, minute thing that we can do on an everyday basis is going to help the environment ultimately.
That's Allison Bonwell. She is a glaciologist at the University of Colorado. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.